Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Scott is joining us today from Rothschild, Wisconsin. He's an emeritus extension wildlife ecologist and been a mainstay on this first Wednesday of the month for many a year. And always great to have him come by to talk about what's going on in wildlife. I know myself, as I do my kind of morning jog at around 5:30, 6 o'clock, the birds, hearing a lot more birds singing. And that's always kind of a lot of fun. And Scott, are you hearing some more birds, too, at that hour?
Well, I'm hearing all sorts of things, Larry, but, gee, you make it seem like we've been doing this for a long time. It's only been about 30 years.
Only 30 years. Oh,
only
my goodness.
30 years.
Oh, man. Well,
there's lots of stuff going on, Larry, and from the looks of the 15-day weather forecast and what I saw this morning for a new 3-month projection, we're looking at a pretty nice spring coming up, starting in about the next 3 days. So it should be really nice.
Well, that is wonderful. And I know you are in Rothschild because you're attending the winter meeting of the Wisconsin chapter of the Wildlife Society, and that's always a great meeting.
Well, it's a great meeting. It's a great meeting for those of us involved in the profession. It's a chance to see old friends that we may not see very often day to day, especially now that I'm kind of out of the loop a bit in semi-retirement. But it is a good meeting. Started last night, runs all day today and into noon tomorrow, and there's about... Oh, there are some 30 presentations by a mix of students and professionals who are here representing the profession as wildlife scientists and in general field of conservation. So those are, I've got kind of a list of topics here that I thought the listeners might find interesting. And I just ducked out to do the program in the middle of the plenary session, which deals with the sustainability of these resources over time. And that started out with a really neat tribal perspective here in the state by a fellow named John Greendeer, and he really had the audience into it in terms of that particular perspective. So it's been very interesting so far, but it's just getting underway.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So that sounded really interesting. Give me a little preview of some of the other things that are happening.
Well, some of the things that I just kind of scanned through the program, some of the things the listeners might be interested in. One talk coming up this afternoon deals with the just getting into the new breeding bird atlas effort,
yeah,
which you may have been talking about, yeah, on the show before, but 2015 was the first of 5 years of data collection for the new iteration of the Breeding Bird Atlas. It's a huge citizen science opportunity. I think they had about 700 observers last year, and you too could be part of this. Anybody listening who's interested in birds, does some birding, wants to submit some information that they collect and get involved, merely has to go to wsobirds.org/atlas. And everything they need to know there is right there to sign up or get involved. So that one's kind of interesting.
There is wsobirds.com/atlas?
.org.
.org, sorry.
Yep, wsobirds.org/atlas, and everything they need to know is right there. There are a couple of papers also this afternoon that deal with evaluations of both the CDAC program, the County Deer Advisory Committee program, and the launch of DMAP, the Deer Management Assistance Program. Both of those are up and running now in the aftermath of the Deer Czar report a few years ago, and both programs seem to be doing very well, and there's an assessment of those. There's a series of papers on various techniques and tools for monitoring birds and mammals. And one that I'm interested in hearing tomorrow morning, since I did a lot of work with the mammalogy class on campus, kind of an interesting paper on studying the climbing abilities of gray fox.
Oh.
And they actually monitored this with trail cameras, different types of trees, different types of bark, and by George, those gray fox can climb up to 15 feet into a tree, and that's kind of neat. There's an interesting one on wood turtle conservation strategies. They're, of course, a threatened species, and that student's going to be reporting on techniques for protecting nest sites. barriers and signage at known road crossings, and also research on nest success. Another one I'm interested in here is studying the impacts of declining ice coverage on Lake Superior and how that's likely to affect mammal populations in the Apostle Islands, and on and on. So
lots of great things.
It's a real opportunity to kind of get up to speed on what folks are doing in the state, and it's a good reflection of how our various academic institutions and agencies like the DNR are trying to stay on top of current topics.
Well, let's one current topic, at least in my mind, is the spring turkey hunting season, which is about a month away now. I know 2014 was a tough year for turkeys. What do we know? What do we know about how they fared this past winter?
Well, at least at this point, it was a pretty mellow winter all the way around from north to south in the state. So from that standpoint, a lot of species, including deer and turkeys and some of the other things we're perhaps overly concerned about, should have done very well. So I think there's high optimism for the turkey season. The permits have been mailed out for successful applicants, and the season does get underway the middle of April and runs for 6 weeks, and there's another opportunity for people who want to participate and either missed out on the permit application back in December or have a permit and simply want to go more often or have more opportunity, and the excess permits, of which there are a lot, will go on sale, I believe it's Monday, March 21st or 2nd, whatever that Monday is, and then each of the major turkey hunting zones will be sold on a daily basis starting with that Monday. So Zone 1 on Monday, Zone 2 on Tuesday, and on Friday to wrap things up, I think, with Zones 5, 6, and 7, which are primarily in the northern part of the state. So, but whether you're a turkey hunter or not, the fact that the turkeys are going to be out there with what looks like 50s and 60s next week, turkeys are going to be out prominently located fields and along roadsides, and there's not much in the spring repertoire of bird activity more spectacular than a big old gobbler in the early morning sun strutting around and gobbling, whether it's in your backyard or a field edge or along the road as you're driving. So that's just one of many things that will be going on in the world of wildlife over the next month or two that people can take advantage of.
I'm telling you, there's nothing more fun than listening, and you know, be just before dawn and then right at dawn this time of the year, or just another week or a couple of weeks down the road, to hear those turkeys gobbling, and you might hear a train whistle and the turkeys will gobble right after it. They'll respond to almost anything at that time.
Yeah, they get pretty worked up, but it's beyond the turkeys. Pheasants will be crowing, the cardinals are already singing, frogs will be calling before long. I wouldn't be surprised if we started to hear wood frogs and spring peepers within the next week or two, which is a bit on the early side, but things are thawing out fast, and that'll bring up plants and fish spawning and bird movements and all sorts of things.
Hearing lots of cardinals in my neighborhood. Todd in La Crosse emailed, and he said he's got... they've still got 3.5 inches of snow, or got 3.5 inches of snow on Monday night, but he saw a couple of red-winged blackbirds at the feeder this morning, so birds are out and around.
It was a very good bird feeding season, at least for me. The weather was moderate enough that I got out and kept the feeders full, and had a nice range of birds this year, and high numbers, this big flocks of goldfinches and house finches, and even some red poles mixed in, which I don't usually get, and my favorite red-bellied woodpecker, who's there every morning right on the bedroom railing. So it's popular for a lot of folks.
We have Connie in Portage with a question, Scott, so let's go there. Connie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. If I understood you right, the season for the turkeys, isn't that when they would be nesting?
Yes. You mean why the heck are we hunting turkeys in the spring as opposed to in the fall like everything else?
I was shocked because my son turkey hunts, but he would never, ever tell. How would you, I don't understand that.
Well, the explanation is actually rather simple, and it makes sense once you hear it, and that is that the behavior of a gobbler turkey and its appearance are so different from that of a hen that they're easily distinguished. And the time that they're vulnerable for hunting is when they're all worked up during the breeding season and subject to being called by people imitating hens or whatever they're doing. They're vulnerable to hunting. They're easily distinguishable from the hens, which are, of course, the population cohort that nests. And a gobbler turkey may service or impregnate many hens, so there's no impact on the population of removing some of those adult gobblers during the spring, even though it is the breeding season. And those are the only turkeys that are legal to be taken, are bearded, well, a bearded turkey, which in rare circumstances could be a hen, but that's very unusual. For the most part, it's adult and juvenile male turkeys that are removed with no impact on the population, but the opportunity to provide some pretty neat hunting opportunity or recreation.
Yeah.
Then when they're hunted, then they're hunted again in the fall, but that's an any turkey season. But at that point, the reproductive season is over. The turkey population's at its annual high with all the young birds in the flock, but they're much more difficult to hunt. It's a very different situation. So spring turkey hunting.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, yeah, there are no toms or no male turkeys sitting on those eggs to help. They don't help the hens. So there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have some good photos, wildlife photos, post those up on our Facebook page, too. We love to see those. We had Matt asked on Facebook, Scott, if the lectures in Rothschild are open to the public.
Yes, to a degree. I mean, there are some related events, so an awards banquet and things like that, that would not be without registration, but I think it's possible to come in if there was a particular talk of interest to come in and hear that in the meeting room. I think they have. I'd have to look down at the registration desk when I go back down. But I think there's a minimal, say, 1 day or session registration if somebody wanted to come in and partake of an afternoon or morning.
Yeah, and I think if you go online, you can go online to the Wildlife Wisconsin chapter of the Wildlife Society. You'll get right away. You'll be able to see the meetings.
Right. And if somebody wanted, we're at the Stony Creek Inn in Rothschild right off the highway and just south of Wausau.
Yeah, there we go. Well, Lori from Spring Valley, Minnesota wants to know if you can recommend a bird monitor that will allow her to hear the birds while she's in the house and her windows are closed.
I would assume that with all the technology involved in, say, baby monitors, or surveillance, remote surveillance, when you're trying to maintain some security in your home while you might be away, that there must be something that could be adapted to that use. I've never seen anything that specifically was here that said, "Here, hang this in a tree, and then you can listen to what's going on, you know, while you're sitting in the bedroom or whatnot." But
I bet you somebody's going to call and let us know, but I bet you could set a baby monitor out by the bird feeder.
I don't see why not, and put it in a weatherproof cover or container or something. And from what I hear from my own kids as they've been monitoring the kids, or even when they're 2,000 miles away, somehow connecting or linking to the baby monitor, that you could probably get both an audio and a video feed, the way people are fascinated by these wildlife cams that are set up around the country.
Absolutely. Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife ecologist extraordinaire. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, our wildlife specialist, and call in with your own questions. We've got an open line at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Jill Nadeau will be our on-air producer. We'll be more than happy to take your call and put you on and get you in line to get on the show, all right? Reed in Cedarburg has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Reed. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. Great program. I've noticed that the Sandhill Cranes have come back, and we just had a pretty good snowfall here in South Detroit, Wisconsin, and I kind of worry about the cranes, whether they'll be able to find something to eat. Normally what they do is they work over the picked over and harvested cornfields, and now with them covered with snow, I'm wondering if it's permissible to put something out for them or if they'll manage on their own.
Well, Reed, I think that the primary consideration is that they should be fine on their own. Most of these, it's a very common reaction, whether it's cranes or robins returning early or a myriad of other birds, that, uh-oh, we got a late snowfall, they're going to be in trouble. And generally speaking, the birds follow the melting contour back. They may even retreat a little bit, depending on the weather, but they should, at this point in the year, after a season on the wintering grounds where the living is pretty good, they come back with adequate resources to withstand a few days of inclement weather. And from the looks of what's going to happen here over the next week or so, they've only got a couple of days to worry about snow cover here, and things are going to be just fine. So I wouldn't worry about intervention, and in some cases, not knowing the feed material that's being used or the other problems and the legality of feeding or baiting these days because of other considerations, it's just a good idea to let nature take its course on this. The birds are well adapted to take care of themselves.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Reed. Appreciate your call. I went over to Facebook for a minute and saw Brandon sent a really cool photo. He delivers mail. Brandon delivers mail near Linden Station, and he's got a shot of a rooster pheasant out the window of his car. He comes. He sees almost daily. Very pretty bird, as it surely is. And he says, "Oh, I hope they make a comeback." Yeah, they're wonderful birds to see. And against the snow, that pretty rooster is really pretty.
We're all hoping for a comeback, Larry.
Yeah, you bet we are. Oh, man. Occasionally, Catherine says, while hunting mushrooms and wild edibles in the spring, I frighten a turkey hen off her nest. Does she come back, or have I scared her off permanently?
No, the bird will come back. Whether it's birds rousted out of a nest box to check a bluebird trail or a turkey accidentally flushed while cutting wood or picking mushrooms or whatever. Again, same situation to a degree as the feeding. The birds are adapted to deal with that kind of disturbance, and the bird will sneak back to its nest as soon as the coast is clear. And
yep.
Generally, no harm to the bird or its incubating eggs.
Let's go back to Reed in Clintonville now. Reed, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, Reed number two. Say, I've just seen two enormous eagles that are, I wasn't sure if they were goldens or if they were bald eagles in juvenile stage, but they were 4.5, 5 feet of wingspan. And we saw, my wife and I saw five of them the other day feeding on a raccoon carcass, same type of bird, a couple of them a little bit smaller. Otherwise, I was wondering if goldens are coming back at plentifully, or maybe I'm just looking at juvenile white or bald eagles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Reed, it could be either one, and my recommendation would be either go online or pick up a bird field guide and look at the characteristics under the wings, and with an adult golden eagle, the golden nape of the neck and so forth, you should be able to make the distinction from your mind's eye observation of what you saw and looking at the images in a field guide or online. But bottom line is it could have been either one. For the past couple of weeks, a friend of mine and a local outdoor writer has been photographing a pair of golden eagles in a little valley just maybe 20 miles west of Madison. in your general direction, and the closer you get to the Mississippi River and the western fringes of the state, the more likely that golden eagles are mixed in. I mean, we're still dominated in this area by resident and nesting and migratory bald eagles, but there are and do seem to be more and more golden eagles mixing in as they're moving through.
We have, Mary in Egg Harbor next with a question. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was visiting a friend in Milwaukee who lives near Whitnall Park, and this was about a month and a half ago. And this critter walks through her backyard, and I looked it up when I got back here in my North American wildlife book, and it seems to be in the pig family, and it looked like a peccary. But what would it be doing here?
Yeah, it'd be an escapee for sure if it was a peccary.
Where are they located?
Southwest part of the country, not part of Wisconsin, a long way from here.
Whoa.
Well, that's an interesting one. I'm trying to think of anything that could possibly look like a peccary as it's wandering around. And wrong time of year for a woodchuck to be out.
No, I know woodchucks from being up in Egg Harbor.
Legs are too short. You know, Larry and I learned a long time ago on this program that it was not in our best interest to say, no, never, impossible, or any such absolute. So as Larry suggested, strange things turn up with disturbing frequency,
yes.
Usually because there's some human involvement, that it's either a release or escape or a prank or something. But I'll tell you what,
it just walked through like it owned the place.
A peccary would be a new one on us.
Yeah, for sure.
But
you're the first to ever mention peccary on this program, I think, Mary.
I'm just racking my brain to think what else it could be, because most of the other species of that size would have a distinctive tail, which the peccary doesn't.
No, it didn't have much of a tail.
And you know the woodchuck. Mary, I don't know what the heck you saw, and I can't rule out the possibility that it was a peccary or something else or a feral. I mean, it's probably more common for some feral swine of some type that might have escaped or wandered off someone's property, or a pot-bellied pig from the pet trade or something. So this will remain a mystery.
All right.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Well, you know, maybe somebody else in Egg Harbor saw that pig-like animal as well, and we'll get another
report. Well, actually,
report.
I think she was from Egg Harbor, but I think the sighting was at Whitnall Park in Milwaukee.
That's right.
So it could. I mean, there's enough people around there, as well as zoos and wildlife parks, have sorted other things. Who knows what might have happened?
We have. I had a listener on Twitter share a photo of a hawk with what appears to be bands. On its tail feathers. It's taken in Brookfield. The hawk was about 18 inches and said the animal ate between 20 and 30 house sparrows over about a two-month period.
Well, good for it. And it was 18 inches is probably a Cooper's hawk, but seems a little big for a Sharpie.
Yeah, it does. I bet it's a Cooper's.
It sounds like a Cooper's hawk. It would have the banded tail, and it would like house sparrows, and then they're very persistent once they find good hunting grounds. So that would be probably the most likely.
Sometimes a red tail, if it's an immature, would have bands on its tail. But
yeah, they're not big on bird consumption, though.
No, you're right. You're right about that. So I think you've made a very astute observation there, Scott Craven. Let's go to Raleigh in Oak Creek next. Hi, Raleigh.
Hi, Scott, Larry. And somehow my call's not going to follow up that pig story. It's not going to be that entertaining, unfortunately.
It's hard to top that one.
Yeah, this is kind of dry. I wanted the opinion of the eminent biologist, Scott Craven, on some of the proposals regarding possibly making certain species of mosquitoes go extinct in light of the various panics we have with the Zika or if it's malaria. And, just intuitively, you think of mosquitoes have been with us for a long time, and they have a certain niche. And whether that's a good idea, in your opinion, of course, different biologists have different opinions, and I wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, I've seen some of the creative devices entrepreneurs have been coming up with to trap and kill mosquitoes, with the notion and the vigor which some of our South American neighbors are putting out their military and everybody else in an attempt to get rid of some of these mosquito populations. But I understand the general dislike of mosquitoes, whether it's one at your backyard picnic or one carrying a really problematic disease like Zika. But on the other hand, our track record of having extinctions or displacements or whatever of any species have more often than not come back to haunt us. So I think that while there might be some immediate appeal to getting rid of populations of mosquitoes, ending any species' existence for good seems like a risky proposition to me. But I defer in the notion of mosquito management to my esteemed colleague, Phil Pelletieri, next time he may surface. But to me, that sounds like probably in the long run an ill-advised and risky proposition.
There we go. I think
thanks, Scott.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling, Raleigh. I think I agree. I will ask that question of Phil the next time he's on, though. Let's turn to John in Stevenson, Michigan. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hey, listen, that person that would like to hear all those birds outside, a baby monitor will work just great. You just put it up underneath the eave outside and make sure you plug it into a ground fault, or some of them you can have electric or battery powered. So yeah, we use them mainly like out in the barns for when the goats are kidding in the spring at about right now, so we can hear when they start to kid, so we can get out there and help them. And when it's not being used for that, we just hang it out underneath the eave. We listen to the coyotes and the birds and the dogs and everything out there that's making noise.
Oh,
that's pretty cool.
That is
around about $40. You can hear everything that's going on out there.
I love it, John. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm going to contact my kids and see if I can repurpose one of their monitors now that they don't need them anymore.
That's why not?
Yeah, why not?
Why the heck not? Thanks again, John. So we got firsthand report there, which is always nice. Diane in Sparta has something for us, a question, I believe. Hi, Diane.
Hi. My question is about coyotes.
Okay.
And at night, we live in the country, and at night I'll often hear a pack of coyotes go like down our road and in our area. Yet during the day, when I see a coyote, I only see one. I don't see a pack. Why aren't they in a pack during the day?
Well, I guess the opposite question is, are they really in a pack at night? And what I mean by that is, I think the perception is that, ooh, they're in a pack, so here's a mass of coyotes that are 2 or 3 feet apart moving across the landscape. And in reality, I think they're much more dispersed than that, and a lot of the communication and vocalization that you hear at night is actually the members of the pack keeping in touch with each other because they're not right next to each other.
Oh.
And therefore, what you see during the night, during the day rather, is probably not a whole lot different than what's actually going on at night. And furthermore, they're such a secretive animal anyway that you might catch a glimpse of one, and there may be others not that far away, but in cover where they're simply not visible. So
yeah.
I don't think there's anything particularly peculiar about that, but now that you mention it, any time I've seen a coyote during the daylight, it's been what appeared to be a solitary individual, whether it's in the woods while I'm hunting or driving or whatever else. But I think it's family mates or pack mates are within communication distance of that animal.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane, for calling. Appreciate your call.
Say, Larry, before you, on the subject of pictures, were you able to post any of the pictures that I sent over the other day?
Yes, we did.
We'll get to those a little later then.
Okay. Yeah, Jill has got them up, and we'll look at those. I did want to mention another photo that Daniel posted, which is really a really cool mount of his first 10-point buck that he got with a bow and arrow. And the as you look at it, it's high on the wall. It appears to almost be the front legs are in the part of the mount. Hmm. It looks as though it's jumping over an old fence and an old truck fender. And he says in his note that the farmer was kind enough to let him have the truck fender and the post, which were right near his stand.
Well, that sounds like a pretty neat mount.
Yeah, it is. So just go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page, and you can see that mount. It's really pretty cool. Kevin and Weyerhaeuser are up next. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And last month I missed a chance to call in, and I was too late when I turned the radio on and realized you were talking about backyard bird feeders and things like that. And I just wanted to share with you, and I have a question for Scott also, about gray squirrels and all the different phases of gray squirrels that we now have in our yard. I live right on the edge of Rust County Forest, mm-hmm. and way up in the woods, and we have lots of gray squirrels here, and black squirrels are common. But this year, I've noticed that our feeders, we have the following phases of color phases of gray squirrels. We have a black squirrel that's all black, including the tail. We have a black squirrel with a reddish blonde tail. Mm-hmm. We have kind of a lighter black, a charcoal colored gray squirrel. And we have a light gray squirrel. And this light color is almost a reddish blonde color.
Mm-hmm.
But the most interesting is the black squirrel with this reddish blonde tail. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's not common here, at least for me. But I wanted to know how common is that in other parts of the state. And the other question I had to do with red poles and pine siskins, which we had as many as 300 birds here at our feeders in a flock at a time.
Well, that's a lot of sunflower seeds disappearing.
we go through a lot of sunflower seeds and thistle seed. I wanted to know, I guess, the red poles and the pine siskins just left finally one day. And then a few came back, and we got not only common red poles, but hoary red poles together in the same flock.
Mm-hmm.
So,
very cool.
I wanted to mention that and the fact that we have three pileated woodpeckers that attend our suet daily, on a daily basis.
Oh, so you have pileateds coming to suet. That's pretty cool.
Yes. And I should send you a picture. I have one on my deck post. He's just landing on my deck post. I'll send that. But our bird feeders have attracted lots of rodents, and as a consequence, we get our share of barred owls, sharp-shinned hawks, northern shrikes, all hunting these critters, and with some success, too.
Sounds like a pretty neat feeding station. It kind of makes my single red-bellied woodpecker seem kind of lame after hearing about that. But back to your squirrel question.
Yes.
One of the pictures I was going to send to Larry to post, along with the ones I did, was actually a trail camera picture from Oneida County, just outside Minocqua, where the trail camera image, it was just a beautiful shot of the forest floor, and there was a black squirrel, a gray squirrel, and a snow-white squirrel in the same trail camera image. And it was just a beautiful picture. So that kind of thing does happen. My experience is that as far as the coloration phases are concerned, that there's more variation in the northern part of the state than in the southern part. It's unusual for us to see a black squirrel down here, whereas they're quite common in the northern forest. The golden yellow color that you describe is sometimes called a Lady Isabella squirrel. It's just another color phase of a normal gray squirrel. We had one on our feeder last winter that my wife named Blondie, and we've been waiting for Blondie to show up again this year, but it has not. But the mixed ones, so the relatively common color phases are normal gray, jet black, white, and blonde. But it seems like over the last 5 or 10 years that I was working at the university and the past few years, that the frequency of some of the kind of mixed ones, like the one you described with the black squirrel with a rusty tail, have become a little more common. And at the university field station, where I spend a fair bit of time, I was seeing some of the feeders there that were either kind of a mahogany brown with a black tail or black with the various shades of brown or gray tails and all sorts of mixtures. And this is just genetic variation in the gray. They're all gray squirrels genetically, but there's some variation in the hair color that pops up occasionally, and for whatever reason, the genetic condition that controls that seems to be becoming a little more variable, and I have no viable explanation for that, but other people have observed the same thing. So
yeah, there we go.
It makes it more interesting to watch squirrels.
It does. At first I thought maybe they were crossbred with fox squirrels, but I haven't seen a fox squirrel here in years. And a few miles south of here, yes, but where I live, up here in the edge of the forest, not too many fox squirrels. But it's still, the shape of the squirrel's tail is still big and fluffy, like a gray squirrel tail,
right,
and like a fox squirrel tail. So I figured it probably had nothing to do with the fox squirrel.
And I think you're right.
You are likely right. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have more callers. Matt in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. I live on the east side of Madison. And we've got something living under our back porch, and I know that just because when we get a fresh snow, we see tracks. So I'm curious what kinds of things it could be, and if it's something we should just live with or have to deal with.
What are the tracks like? Are they?
So there's sort of a back foot's probably about 3/4 inch print, and there's a definite tail in between the two prints.
Are the toes very distinctive? Let's go back to the possibilities first.
Yeah, exactly.
The most likely culprits, there are four: possum, raccoon, skunk, and cat.
Those much smaller. Yeah, it's much smaller than that, than any of those, though. I'm thinking either potentially a rat or a small mouse or a large mouse.
Oh, so it's at that size.
I don't
size.
Know. 3/4 inch track is you know, within the possibility of even a possum foot, and with that distinct tail you mentioned.
Would a possum be able to jump, leap? Like this morning, the tracks were maybe a foot apart.
Possums aren't known for doing anything quickly or agilely, so maybe that rules out possum. The size is such that not big enough for a rabbit track. A rat would have a distinctive tail drag, too, and I guess that's a possibility, and they're as agile as any animal out there.
Yeah.
But there's only a couple alternatives in terms of figuring out what it is, for sure. And that's either happening to see it, catch it, set a live trap just to see what the heck it is, and remove it if you wish. Or third, borrow a trail camera from somebody. They're very common these days, or not particularly expensive to obtain, and then set that up on wherever it seems to be going into or out of the deck area and see what it is with a photograph.
Yeah.
So once it's resolved, then you can make a more informed decision about what to do about it. At least in the short run, if there's no evidence that it's attempting to get into the house under the sill plate or whatever, then as long as there's no problem, it's an interesting curiosity and you don't need to be too anxious about it. But if there's any damage under there, or if it turned out to be a skunk, for example, we don't want a skunk under the deck, then there are things you do to skirt the deck or remove the animal so that the problem goes away.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife expert, and join in with your own questions. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. You can post photos and questions on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or call it 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. We did, Scott, we had, if you'll remember, that we had the lady from Egg Harbor who had seen what looked like a pig, a peccary, and Sharon comments that she wonders if it wasn't an opossum, but it did have a very short tail. I suppose an opossum could lose its tail.
Yeah, that's possible, although the possums are so silvery gray and have that weird naked nose and whatnot. Who knows? Stranger things have happened when it comes to wildlife observation and identification. But there are also some small breeds of dogs that have a kind of that strange appearance. And in a setting like that in the Milwaukee area, it could have been somebody's pet too. Who knows?
Gary and Shano has a comment. Hi, Gary. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I've listened to your program for the last year or so since I've lived over here, and I always wanted to call about the melanistic squirrels, the black squirrels.
Yeah.
And has anybody did a study of the occurrence, or there getting to be more and more of them? I can remember the first one I saw was maybe like 30 or 40 years ago, and I saw roadkill it. I backed up, and it was a black squirrel. I was so excited about this, and I skinned it, took it home, was going to mount it or something, and put it in my freezer. And after a couple of years, my wife at the time took offense to it, and I lost that one. But are black squirrels becoming more prevalent? I mean, here in Shawano, I see maybe 20%, maybe more, black.
Yeah.
I think your observation is correct that they seem to be becoming more prevalent, but I can offer no good explanation why. Some of the color variations, for example, either an albino or a leucistic squirrel, either condition that makes them white, I think it's obvious that those animals are much more vulnerable to predation because they're so visible in the summer environment. So that where white phases have predominated, it tends to be in urban parks or suburban neighborhoods where they're offered some protection from normal wild levels of predation. The black phase does seem to be becoming more common. At least that's my perception. My perception is like yours. Years ago when I first saw a black squirrel, holy cow, it was pretty exciting, and you talked about it with people. But now when they come up, lots of people will call in or share experiences. Oh, sure, we've got them around or we see them regularly. What it is about any selective advantage that they may have that's causing that genetic circumstance to increase in the population, I can only speculate on, but I'm not aware of any studies. That doesn't mean there haven't been any that explore whether they're really truly increasing or not, or whether this is just our perception.
There you go. Thanks so much, Gary, for calling. Appreciate it. We have a photo up from Rudy, a really nice photo of an eagle. Took the photo near Lake Puckaway in Green Lake County. The eagle was feeding on a deer carcass near the road and allowed Rudy to take some great photos. And that's up on our Facebook page.
Oh, good.
And I also let's go back to those photos that you took, Scott, because I think that's a really cool story.
Well, the ones, I think the ones you have are probably two that, one is the one taken from the ice looking back at the front of my cabin in Price County.
Yeah.
And the foreground, for people who are able to look at it, they can see clearly what's going on. But the description is, standing on the ice, looking back at my cabin, right in the foreground is what's left of a deer, which is not much more than hide. and then between the photographer and my dock, which might be a distance of 100 feet or whatever, everything on the ice surface is just packed flat. There's blood here and there, and then, boom, there's my cabin. And the this was a week ago Thursday, I guess, that the neighbor sent that picture and a whole series of others and indicated as best they could determine from the tracks that left the site. And there's another picture that show the wolf tracks moving off across the snow-covered surface of the lake, was that a pack of 8 to 10 wolves took down a deer literally at the end of my dock, killed it, consumed it completely, packed down the area, and then off across the lake go the 8 or 10 sets of wolf tracks. And it's a really neat picture, but when that's at literally at your front door, it gives you kind of a new perspective on how predation fits into the world of life in the North Woods. And I know my wife's a little nervous. We're headed up there tomorrow, and she says, "Oh my gosh, what about the dogs?" Well, the wolves are probably long gone, but in any event, it was an interesting photograph. The other one, when we were up there a couple of weeks ago, my wife looked out the back door after the dog had come in at 10 o'clock at night. She said, "There's something walking over here from the neighbor's place." And I got up and looked, and out of the shadows into the light at our back door came the bobcat that's photographed the other incident. And it kind of meandered around and looked up at us. I thought it was going to walk up the back steps to the door, but it eventually moved off into the shadows on the other side of the property and disappeared. And come to find out, the neighbors have been seeing as many as 3 or 4 at a time, apparently 2 adults and 2 young ones that have been taken to meandering around the properties, perhaps looking for something to eat. But that was a pretty neat situation, too. So. Yeah.
And those are up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and a whole bunch more. We'll be talking about some more photos. There's a great one of a barred owl. Just a wonderful shot, and some others, too. We'll get to those in a minute, but I want to give Jim and Stone Lake a chance to join in. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
I haven't had any cardinals here this winter, and normally I have like 6 or 7. I was wondering, are their numbers down or what?
Well, it's pretty common, Jim, when someone with a feeder or any other thing where you have a routine expectation of certain species or certain numbers, that when anything deviates from that, there's suspicion that something not good is going on. But usually it just means either it's an open winter and the birds are not as dependent on feeders, somebody down the road has put out a bigger or better feeder, or there's some other explanation that doesn't involve some sort of a calamity. On the other hand, not this past winter, I've only had maybe on average 2 or 3, maybe 4 cardinals at a time at my feeding station, whereas the previous winter, which was a bad one, I can remember counting 15 or 20 sometimes at a time. So I think it's more related to the proximate conditions of what's going on now, and if the weather changes or in another season, you'll probably have your normal number of cardinals back.
And somebody was telling me, I just, within the last day or two, of having somewhere between 20 and 30 in a single tree in Madison.
Hmm.
So I was almost hard to believe.
Well, and the other lesson with that, Larry, is that these animals, no animals, whether it's cardinals or possums or rats or whatever else, are uniformly distributed across the landscape. So at any given time, some places are more attractive to others because of a food source or solar exposure or whatever, and that's where they're going to be.
Just some emails. Susan emailed to say that they have seen black squirrels on the far south side of Racine.
Hmm.
So they're...
Okay. They're around.
They're around, and Kay wondered about fox squirrels. They seem to have disappeared from her area. They're in Clark County. I don't think they've disappeared, though, have they?
No, I don't think so. Fox squirrels are a little different in their habitat preference, liking kind of open farmland and scattered woodlots and fence rows. And you'll see them sometimes quite a ways from trees or along the roadside. And as some of these environments grow up a little more or are developed, depending on the situation around Kay's house, it may just be a change that means it's no longer viewed by the fox squirrels as being good habitat.
Yeah. Tom in Green Bay, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Some comments on the gray squirrels. I've looked at these for quite some time because research I do on northern goshawks. When I started back in the 1960s, black squirrels were pretty localized and somewhat rare. The fellow from Shawano is correct. I have relatives buried at the cemetery on the east side of Shawano that used to be right on the highway, and I could remember that was where I saw my first black squirrels back in the 1950s, and they're still there. I attended a funeral a few years ago, and I was amazed that there were still black squirrels running around that nice woods in there with hardwoods. Apparently, from the old records, when we had a mixed forest, black squirrels were dominant. And this is the way they are up on the Canadian Shield. If you go to Niagara Falls, the entire population in town is black. And when we clear-cut everything, when we cut down the forest and we burnt it and tried to farm it, apparently the gray phase is what dominated.
That's interesting. We're starting to run out of time here, Tom, but a quick comment from you, Scott?
Interesting observation. I'm just listening and trying to figure out what it is about the landscape change that will allow one of those phases to flourish at the expense of the other, but maybe we can pick this up after the break.
We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be right back. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, and wonderful to have him be with us today to talk about what's going on in the world of wildlife. You've been wonderful. You've been calling in with your questions and with your comments and experiences. That's always a lot of fun, and I hope you'll continue to do that. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Scott, when we left, you were making some comments, and I suddenly blanked on what those comments were. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, we were talking about the caller from UW Green Bay who had history with squirrel observations and confirmed that Shawano was kind of a hotbed of melanistic or black squirrels and had been since the 50s and 60s. The discussion was moving toward landscape-level changes that seem to favor one color phase over another, which is quite possible, but I was still thinking about what kinds of changes would favor one color. I mentioned what might affect the white ones when they're so vulnerable to predation, but that's kind of where we left it. So maybe that's something I can do a little more legwork on, and next time I'm on, we'll explore that a bit.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun to do.
I did want to mention one thing, Larry, before if we could. There's been a lot of buzz about the DNR moving to their new Go Wild initiative, which is a major change in the licensing system. In other words, all things that people do with the outdoors, registrations, boat registrations, ATVs, access permits for trails, harvest registration, buying licenses, permits, all this stuff is going into a new high-tech system that they're referring to as Go Wild. And it's particularly germane right now for two reasons. Number one, all of our various licenses, fishing and hunting, expire at the end of March. So people will be moving to buy new licenses for the next 12-month period. And secondly, the third week of March, the leftover turkey permits that we talked about earlier will go on sale. So I know they're working diligently to get that whole system up and running, which will even require new hardware at license vendors. And the initial report in Wisconsin Outdoor News a week or so ago was that things would be rolled out in early March, but I was just told by some of my colleagues here at the meeting that a press release went out yesterday that it's been delayed a bit, but they're hoping to have everything up and running now by the time those turkey permits go on sale later on in March, about the third week of the month. So there may be a period here where licensed vendors and whatnot may have some difficulties selling things people are interested in. So bottom line is, be patient. This will be a pretty cool new system, which will be a one-stop source for all these kinds of things. Just need to get it going.
I still like stopping by the DNR office and picking up the stamps.
Right.
And so forth. So, and I guess you can still have that opportunity.
I think you'll still be able to do that, and you can still, when you, for example, if you buy a patron's license, I think there's still an opportunity to indicate that you collect or save the stamps, and they can then be sent, or at least previously they were sent to you later on in the season.
Yeah.
So anyway, new system coming online, but as with any new high-tech stuff, there's a learning curve and some issues in terms of implementation. So they're working on it, and it should be up and running soon.
Yep. Let's go to Paul in Duluth, Minnesota, next for a comment. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I'm calling hoping to glean some fisher insights from Scott. I had a somewhat unique encounter with a fisher while bull hunting in northern Bayfield County. I went into my tree stand, placed my camouflage fanny pack at the base of the tree, climbed up and sat for a few hours, and then probably about a half hour before sunset, I heard some rustling and a fisher came sauntering in, and it nosed up to my fanny pack. And as I was looking down on this, I thought, well, it's kind of cute, you know, it's something unique to experience here. And then the fisher grabs the fanny pack in his mouth and starts backpedaling through the woods, dragging my fanny pack. And so I was faced with a real important decision here. Do I stay in the stand and not blow my cover? You know, it was, you know, right during the rut, and I didn't want to sacrifice the hunting. At the same time, I didn't want to see this fanny pack with my first ever hunting knife and some other sentimental things hauled off by this critter. So I let it go for a while, and it was just kind of slowly proceeding, backpedaling, and I could kind of watch it, and it was not making very good progress, so I thought I could wait it out. And eventually it got down to probably the last 5-10 minutes of light, and I could still hear the fisher dragging my fanny pack, but I could not see it. So at great risk, I decided to get down, not knowing who would win should we have an encounter. I went towards the sound, and then the sound stopped, and I was back in the middle of the woods, and the fisher and the fanny pack were never to be seen again. So the fisher won me 0, I guess, is the final tally there. But
so you never did get the pack back?
I did not. I did many ground searches the week after and never found it. And I guess my question ultimately is, do you have any keen insights on fishers and their relations to fanny packs, how far they might drag it? Is it something they would bury, something they would suspend in a tree or go shopping with? I don't really know.
Yeah.
My first observation is that your initial decision to wait it out as opposed to acting in a timely fashion may not have been prudent. But in any event, I have no idea what the fisher was interested in, except there had to be something by way of scent or a granola bar, or I don't know what you had in the fanny pack, but there had to be something in there that the fisher was interested in for whatever reason. As far as where it went and then disappeared under the cover of darkness, I mean, they're pretty agile. If the sound stopped, you know, I'm inclined to think it may have gone up a tree or a downed log or something like that, where the pack got dragged into a hollow log that had been down or something and seemingly vanished. But that's going to have to remain in the realm of the unknown. So bummer about your original hunting knife, but next time a fisher's dragging away your pack, I'd move more quickly.
There you go. Thanks, Paul. That's a great story. Loved hearing that one. Oh, man. Ben in Franklin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I got an interesting question, at least to me. I live in Franklin, Wisconsin here, and it's a newer neighborhood, about 20 years old, and there's a lot of wildlife are moving in. But I saw in the backyard what looked like a mountain lion, or not a mountain lion, an African lion walking through, about the size of a 30-pound dog. And I would never have brought this up, but a few days later, about a mile or two down the road, a neighbor of mine described the exact same thing without me prompting him. So I was wondering if you would know what that might be.
Well, Larry, correct me. I mean, there's something in my increasingly foggy memory that suggests that wasn't there a big fracas about a presumed small African lion that the authorities were pursuing over that way somewhere a few months ago?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember if that's consistent with your observation, but there was kind of a media uproar about sightings of a of a purported African lion, and I don't think anything ever came of it.
Right.
But so
it was very small. It was not large. It was odd. It looked exactly like a lion. It's a squarish body, the coloration, the shoulders going up and down, the large paws.
There is a dog. There is a dog that I sometimes the hair is cut in such a fashion, and I can't remember the breed, that it looks like kind of like a lion mane.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, Larry. They leave some longer fur around the around the head and the nape of the neck, but then shear the rest of the animal. So
it looked like a female. It didn't have a mane.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a bobcat or a lynx, because I know what those look like.
I'm sticking with
I don't know if this is related to all the other observations or not, but I think in this case, especially in the kind of a well-developed neighborhood that you described, that a pet something that had a lion-like appearance, or at least the coloration, seems like a more plausible explanation than any kind of wild animal, although there are occasionally... The only other thing I can think of that would be that size would be a mangy. If you get a fox, they're sometimes called a Samson fox. They have no guard hairs, so they look very sleek and short-haired, or they can be mangy and also lose their hair, that they would have at least that beigey coloration and about the right size. Although a fox head doesn't look so much like a... Like a cat with a blunt face as opposed to a long muzzle. So, I don't know.
I don't know either, but thanks a lot for calling, Ben. I appreciate your call. I just go to quickly to our Facebook page because there's so much coming in. Edwin sent a video of a bull moose strolling through his yard in Presque Isle.
Wow, that's cool.
Emily sent a photo, one of the great photos that I've seen of some hen turkeys in the they're all looking in one direction, a great close-up. I really like it. There's another photo from Chris of a bear near Solberg Lake Ski Trail in Price County. I know that. I know Solberg Lake very well. I caught my first muskie ever in Solberg Lake. But this bear looked pretty groggy, and it's now kind of like leaning up against a tree like it's going to climb the tree. That was from about 2 weeks ago. It's a really cool picture of a black bear, though. And then there's another photo, and I'm sure you don't have your able to look on Facebook at the moment, but Rick sent a photo and wanted your opinion of is whether or not this the trail cam photo is a coyote or a wolf.
Okay.
And it's hard to judge. You know, it's black and white, and it's...
Well, you have to look at the blockiness of the head, the pointed narrow muzzle, as opposed to a really blocky muzzle on the wolf, the length of the legs, the size of the paws, how the tail is held.
You can't see the
tail. I don't have access to look at it, but it occurs to me with your descriptions, Larry, that we ought to talk someday about somehow striking a deal with your many listeners in all these great photographs and sometimes the stories that go along with them, that it would... It'd be kind of neat to figure out some way to assemble these into either a digital or, you know, print version of Wisconsin wildlife photos and encounter stories or something.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be a neat project.
Yeah, there's a great... George sent one a couple of photos of a barred owl, really close up his wife took of a barred owl from... I think she took it from her living room window. It looks like she took it from outside, though, because it's very close. Mike sent a video of his feeder, and I can't tell, is it a turkey that's hanging on the feeder? Oh, no. It's a woodpecker, but I can't tell if it's a pileated. Anyway, it's a fairly large one, and it's really beating up his hanging that he's got there, which is also pretty cool. So there's a lot of really cool things, and then along with your photos, there's a lot to see. And I don't know that I mentioned Rudy's, but Rudy took a great one of a bald eagle too that was feeding on a deer carcass. So lots.
Well, it's a lot to see, and it speaks to the value of the public in terms of citizen science. I mean, people are just collecting these things because they're keenly interested in what they're seeing. But the reality is it's possible for people who are managing these wildlife populations to collect all kinds of information and behavioral photographs that we just never had access to before all this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. There was, I wanted to point out, there was one other, oh yeah, Beverly emailed to say that she has a Wind Song microphone that she purchased at Wild Birds Unlimited, and it really works well for listening to birds.
Ah, okay, there you go. So there is a commercial version of the baby monitor.
Yep.
Somebody caught on and beat us to it again, Larry.
There we go. Oh, man. Linda in McHenry, Illinois, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. I'm really enjoying your show. I listen all the time. We had a really unfortunate thing happen over the weekend. We came home Saturday night, and our bird cage was open. And I thought, oh, I must have left it open a little bit. And so we started looking for our bird, a cockatiel, and we couldn't find him anywhere, which is weird. And we couldn't hear him. And then we saw a creature run across our basement floor, and it ran to our sump pit, and we opened it up, and it was a white weasel. Hmm. And it went into the tube that it apparently had come into the house from, which leads someplace, you know, near the foundation. And we got it to stay in there, though it looked out at us two or three times. And then my husband put something over the opening and then taped it shut. And now he's got a contraption hooked up to a live trap so that maybe we can catch it. But if we catch it in the live trap, how far away do we have to take it to have it not come back?
Well, wait a second now. Was the weasel, what happened to the cockatiel?
I think it ate it.
Oh, you never found it at all? Not even?
Never found it. We found some feathers.
Oh,
and
you did.
When I cleaned out the cage, there was blood. So it was, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm the only person I've ever known that had a wild animal come in their house and steal their pet. But,
wow, that is really weird.
Yeah.
I would think, a cockatiel is a pretty good-sized bird. I would think there must have been a lot of feathers or remains somewhere. A weasel's not
We looked everywhere, and it was dark in the house, so the bird wouldn't want to be flying around the house voluntarily. I mean, it might have been chased. But I think that it had also knocked two things off the top of the cage, which is what I saw first when we walked in. It's like, why would the bird go up on top of the cage and knock off these two big things? Because the bird doesn't weigh very much. And then when we couldn't find it and we found the weasel, we figured that might have happened. Last winter, I had two pigeons in an outdoor pen where I keep ducks and pigeons and sometimes pheasants. And the pigeons disappeared one after the other a week apart, and it's chain link, so it's not, you know, tight mesh. And I thought last year that maybe we had a weasel or maybe we had a mink or something, because in that case there was no sign of a struggle. Whatever got them took them away very efficiently.
Wow.
Well, that's quite a story. I'm sorry about the loss of your cockatiel, but weasels are very flexible, obviously, and they have the shape for moving through sump pump PVC just the way you describe. But what got it? I've got to think that it got into the house more by accident, exploring the outbound pipe, and got into the house, and the cockatiel was just a was, from the weasel's perspective, just a bit of good luck.
Yeah.
But back to your original question, if he catches the animal alive And in terms of removing it, they're not an animal that moves long distances across the landscape, so I would think if he, you know, 3 or 4 miles ought to be plenty to relocate it.
Yeah, there you go.
And pick an environment where there's lots of debris and down timber and things like that, not near someone else's house where it may be.
Yeah,
or it may be a problem for someone else or their pets, but do it that way and you should be fine. That's not to say that there aren't going to be more of them around, so you'll have to be vigilant. And at least on all my sump pump exit pipes and so forth, I've taken a 4-inch square of quarter-inch hardware cloth and then bent that over the pipe, which doesn't impede water flow, but bent it over the pipe and then wired it down, and then nothing, whether it's deer mice or weasels or anything else, nothing can get into the house that way.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Linda, for calling. Matthew in Blue Mounds has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Matthew, hi.
Hey, guys. Happy pseudo-spring.
Yes.
Say, we raise a lot of ducks and chickens and turkeys out here, and when we first moved out here in the early 80s, we had Bob Whites and quite a few ringtails. And I was toying with the idea of raising chicks and releasing them, and I was looking for a little information and success rate and whether it's worth a go to do that, Scott.
Well, you know, if you, for pheasants or quail or whatever, for quail, as far as they're concerned, we're really right on the edge of their northern distribution. And I, over the 20 years I've been in my current house, maybe 5 years out of 20, I'll have a whistling male Bob White in the or two in the 12 acres, and it's great to hear them. But once we get a bad winter, they're gone.
They're gone.
And I haven't seen one for 5 or 6 years, since the pheasants were virtually wiped out by those big, heavy, icy springs 3 or 4 years ago. Certainly people are putting birds out on the landscape from the standpoint of trying to perpetuate hunting opportunity or whatnot, and any of the Hook and Bullet magazines will have classified ads in the back section for pheasant chicks, quail, whatever, from various game farms that can be purchased for raising and release. And the DNR still provides some pheasant chicks from the game farm in Poinette to either conservation clubs or other groups trying to raise them. So you could look into that. And there's quite a literature on raising these things in captivity. Their survival is pretty minimal, especially for the quail. In the case of the pheasants, it's pretty minimal too, but obviously there were some successes at some point in history because, of course, all our pheasants trace their ancestry to releases that started way back in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it's possible, but you have to be a little bit careful because there are always concerns over diseases from captive birds being introduced into wild populations and so forth. So I would check with your local wildlife manager in, I guess it's Iowa County, and see what they can do to advise you. And there's quite a bit of literature available on what to do and how to do it.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. And Scott, thank you so much. Have some more fun at the winter meeting of the Wildlife Society Wisconsin chapter. Appreciate your time, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks.
Well, I'm going to start with lunch and go from there. So
there you go.
Take care and enjoy spring, everybody.
Thank you, Scott. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He'll be back, and we will talk with him again for sure. Tomorrow there's a fun book out. It's called Portage, A Family, A Canoe, and the Search for the Good Life. I'm enjoying reading it right now, and that's at 11 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening, and please do stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.